Welcome to the third of the summer series. It's an honor to introduce the dynamic duo to you. Glenn C. Altshuler is Dean of the School of Continuing Education in Summer Sessions and the Thomas and Dorothy Litwin Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. Glenn received his PhD in American History from Cornell in 1976, and he has been an administrator and teacher here since 1981. He is the author or co-author of 10 books and more than 800 essays, book reviews, and op-eds. The National Book Critics Circle has cited his work as, quote, exemplary, and Psychology Today has featured it as essential reading. For 4 years, he wrote a column for the Education Life section of the New York Times. From 2002 to 2005, he was a regular panelist on national and international affairs for the WCNY television program, The Ivory Tower Half Hour. Glenn is a recipient of the Clark Teaching Award, the Donna and Robert Paul Award for Excellence in Faculty Advising, and the Kendall S. Carpenter Memorial Award for Outstanding Advising. He is a Weiss Presidential Fellow. Glenn has been an animating force in the American Studies program. He teaches large lecture courses in American popular culture, and he continues to be a strong advocate on campus for high-quality undergraduate teaching and advising. Isaac Kramnick is the Richard J. Schwartz Professor of Government at Cornell, where he has taught since 1972. Prior to coming to Cornell, he had taught at Harvard, Brandeis, and Yale. He is from rural Massachusetts, and he was educated at Harvard and Cambridge University. Isaac has taught and written or edited some 20 books, principally in the area of English and American political thought and history. He is the recipient of a number of awards, fellowships, and honors. He is a fellow of Britain's Royal Historical Society, and he has served as president of the American Society for 18th Century Studies. In 1998, he was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. At Cornell, he has received the Clark Teaching Award, and he is a Weiss Presidential Fellow. In 1996, he was chosen through student ballots as the Cornell Daily Sun's favorite professor of the year. Isaac was vice provost for undergraduate education at Cornell from 2001 to 2005. He served his colleagues as chair of the Department of Government from 1981 to 1985, and again from 1996 to 2001. He was associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences from 1986 to 1989, and a faculty elected trustee on the university's Board of Trustees from 1990 to 1994. Glenn and Isaac's book, Cornell: A History 1940 to 2015, will be published in late August. The Cornell University Press, I'm told, is taking pre-orders in the lobby. Is that so? Okay. While we're waiting for that, though, let's listen to The Way We Were and Are, Reflections on Students and Faculty at Cornell. Glenn? Now applause.
Thanks, Charles, for that gracious introduction. And I'm particularly appreciative of it because I know that introductions are not always gracious. I'm reminded of a time some years ago when the eminent and eminently cantankerous Professor Oscar Handlin introduced one of my colleagues to a large audience at Harvard as follows. Stuart Blumen thinks he knows something about American urban history. We'll see. So Isaac and I each are going to talk a little bit about Cornell students and faculty over the last decades. I'm going to talk about students, and Isaac is going to talk about faculty, and then we will take your questions, should you have some, or your praise, which I'm sure you will have. And then you can go out and make bulk purchases of our book. In his commencement address in June 1960, with his tongue tucked snugly in his cheek, President Waldo Dean Mallott imagined the return of the class of 1960 for its 40th reunion in the year 2000. You will reminisce about your long-ago student days, the president predicted, contrasting travel on the old Lehigh Valley Railroad with now routine trips in rocket capsules. No one will be overweight because Cornell's Graduate School of Nutrition and Cornell's Medical College in New York City will have helped eliminate obesity. You will express shock at the tuition announced for the year 2001. But, Mallott said, and I quote, "I shall not disturb the equanimity of the occasion by giving voice to the actual amount, because your sons and daughters will have graduated from Cornell just before the new century began." You will also be startled to hear Mallott announce that the president is anti-fraternity, the result of a policy enacted in 1981 to defer rushing to the sophomore year under a tentative plan developed by the Interfraternity Council to be reappraised after a 100-year trial. Mallott declared as well that the 1960 graduates would perhaps be less surprised to hear that the Cornell Daily Sun had been campaigning vigorously against the administration because of the use of immature and unintelligent pigs for experimental purposes. Yes, times have changed, the president acknowledged, but he urged his audience to remember that Cornell was born of protest to the existing order of 19th century academic institutions. It will be a tragic day, President Mallott concluded, when students are no longer willing to probe and explore, to innovate, and to experiment. As President Mallott suggested, Cornell's student body is best understood as changed, changing, and changeless. It remains, for example, the most democratic ivy. For this reason, in fact, it does not look like it did when he was president. At the end of World War II, and when Cornell celebrated its centennial in 1965, students were mostly male. Almost all of them were white. The class of 2017 is much more diverse. Some 16% are Asian, 12% Hispanic, 7% African American. More than 2% of these undergraduates are biracial or multiracial. 11% of undergraduates are international students. Women constitute a sizable percentage and often a majority in every college at Cornell. Like their counterparts in every generation, millennial students exhibit a wide array of tastes and temperaments. But since, rightly or wrongly, Cornell retains its reputation as a pressure cooker, virtually all of them study a lot. They crowd into Eurus, hunker down in the Olin Stacks, set up shop in the Green Dragon in Sibley, or in a classroom on the first floor of Goldwin Smith, which is always unlocked. Wanting to see and be seen, Cornell students have become adept at the practice known for 30 years as FaceTime. A low attrition rate, 96% of first-year students return for their sophomore year, has not relieved the anxiety of many Cornell undergraduates. Neither has grade inflation. Almost 40% of all grades at Cornell are now A's. C's and D's are endangered species. Since grade inflation is rampant throughout the rest of the Ivy League as well, students still feel they need a leg up in the stiff competition for spots in professional schools and for good jobs. In 1994, an ILR professor lamented that students in my class view a grade on a paper as my opening bid. Like their peers at most colleges and universities, a significant number of Cornell students cheat. There has been much in the media about this current generation of students as a generation of cheaters. In the internet age, cheating may well be even more pervasive and difficult to detect. But, and I don't know if you'll take this as good news or bad news, Cornell students have always cheated. Many of you, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands for those of you who graduated from Cornell, but we may have some in the audience. A survey some years ago documents the extent of academic dishonesty at Cornell and the various forms it takes. 10% said they changed an answer on a returned exam and then asked for a regrade. 11% indicated they used a cheat sheet on an exam. 25% asked a classmate to look at their answers. 32% said they made up an excuse to get an extension. 33% plagiarized. 37% shared the content of an exam with a friend before she or he sat for it. 72% worked on a lab report, problem set, or term paper with another student without the permission of the instructor. And those are just the students taking Kramnik's courses. And drinking remains a staple of the work hard, play hard Cornell culture. We know less about drug use these days, although Isaac and I suspect that with the exception of marijuana, it is less prevalent than it was in the 60s and 70s. But drinking is not. Students drink to forget stress, lower inhibitions, and quite often because their friends drink and they cannot come up with anything better to do. Things changed a bit, as some of you may recall, on December 1, 1985, when New York State raised the minimum age for the purchase of alcohol to 21. Duffy's Tavern closed in 1986. Johnny's Big Red Grill, where Peter Yarrow sang, Harry Chapin got his first gig, Richard Farina was a regular, and Vladimir Nabokov, rumor had it, once lived upstairs, soon followed. Although, as many of you know, the neon sign of Johnny's Big Red Grill, which has landmark status, has stayed up. And the chapter house began inviting students to drown their sorrows in fruit juice. Nonetheless, students have found ways to get high above Cayuga's waters. It's a joke. Try to give me a little encouragement here if you can. It's lonely up here at the podium. Surveys indicate that about 85% of students drink, about 20% of them fitting the definition of heavy drinkers. They drink in residence halls, and despite vigorous efforts by university officials, in fraternity and sorority houses, at tailgating parties outside Cholcoff Field, and on slope day. Drunk or sober, many students devote a great deal of time to hanging out and hooking up. Quick sexual encounters with roommates, friends, and lovers. Public manifestations of affection are much more in evidence these days. As in the past, however, students prefer to live up or down to Cornell musts, myths, and modes of operation, and on occasion to introduce new ones. There is, and always has been, a lot to do on the Cornell campus. There are some 800 clubs at Cornell, with scores of new ones appearing each year. In an alumni news survey about her graduating class, Diana Catcher Bledder, class of 78, claimed that in 1 week she heard a lecture on Polish poetry, attended a class in Japanese no dancing, listened to a reading by Allen Ginsberg, jumped on a trampoline, taken a wine tasting test, camped out near Cayuga Lake, and joined a political protest at the Strait, acknowledging that she was romanticizing, diving heartfirst into sentimentality. She brushed aside Cornell's bureaucracy, its lack of compassion, computerized registration forms, racial tensions, pre-professional grinding, and competition to confess, quote, "I loved it here. I really did." Mark Schwartz, from the class of 1984, told the Cornell Daily Sun, "You're not a true Cornelian unless you climb to the top of the clock tower, tromp through the apple orchards, swim in the gorges, and take a seemingly irrelevant course." He didn't mention a list of professors who teach those courses. Surprisingly, perhaps, his list did not include throwing fish on the ice or tying a chicken to the net during a Cornell-Harvard hockey game. And I'm looking at my friend, athletic director Andy Noel, and he's hoping that those traditions will return, aren't you, Andy? Maybe not. In changing and changeless Cornell, students said goodbye to some traditions and invented new ones. In the year 2000, Bob Petrillis sold his hot truck, a name chosen to differentiate his menu, PMP, or Poor Man's Pizza, and MCB, Meatball and Cheese, which used French bread from his father's restaurant, Johnny's Big Red Grill. He sold the hot truck to Albert Smith, class of 71, owner of the Shortstop Deli in downtown Ithaca. In 2006, students and alumni and members of the community bid farewell to Walter Lefebvre, a fabled teacher, scholar, and mentor at the university since 1959, whose History of American Foreign Policy course, taught on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays — those were the days when Saturday and even Friday were in the schedule — attracted hundreds of students who applauded at the end of every lecture, delivered impeccably and without notes. Among the new traditions and additions to university lore was the appearance — many of you remember this — in the dark hours of October 7th to 8th, 1997, of what appeared to be a hollowed-out pumpkin on the top of McGraw Tower spire, 173 feet above the ground. Amidst speculation of who done it and how they did it, Andy Pearson, class of 01, declared it was aliens. President Hunter Rawling quipped that, standing on his tiptoes, he had done it himself. With the mystery still unsolved, we ask that the perpetrator, who may be in this room, identify himself or herself. In the 21st century, Cornell students are less interested in political causes than were their counterparts in the 1960s and 70s, though they're almost certainly more engaged than were undergraduates in the first 100 years of the university's existence. Of course, the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, commanded the attention of everyone on campus. And in the fall of 2005, Cornell students played a leading role in welcoming students from Tulane University, Dillard University, Xavier University, and the University of New Orleans, all of which had been forced to close their doors following the devastation visited on New Orleans by Hurricane Katrina. Students in dormitories, fraternities, sororities, and off-campus apartments made room for the visitors, shared notes with them, and welcomed them into their study groups. Our image of the cutthroat Cornell student has vanished over the past few days, said Tulane undergraduate Lindsay Oliver. You tell them you're from Tulane, and everything changes. It was quite a wonderful moment for Cornell. In the absence of a disaster of the proportions of 9/11 or Katrina, however, activists find it difficult to mobilize large numbers of students and command the attention of the campus for more than a few days. And as you know, in the last 10 years, Cornell has been at war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and a relatively small number of students have been sufficiently engaged to protest actively and to maintain their interest in ending the war. Cornell students have seldom rallied in the numbers of their predecessors. In the presidential election of 2012, for example, there were no speeches or rallies by Cornell Republicans or Democrats in front of the Strait at lunchtime. The stump, which some of you may remember, is dead. In accounting for the apathy of his generation, Steve Grossman, class of 07, program chair of the Cornell Democrats, claimed that the challenges of the 21st century were not as immediate to his contemporaries, who were preoccupied with getting good jobs as they had been to draft-eligible Vietnam-era undergraduates. Student activists have had somewhat better luck enlisting support for environmental causes with local implications. Some of you may remember the Redbud Woods Working Group, which fought for years to prevent nearly 3 acres from becoming a parking lot to serve West Campus students. We've also had students against sweatshops. A Cornell branch of Kyoto Now demanding compliance with treaties on climate change. And just recently, a petition to President Scorton and the Board of Trustees to fully withdraw Cornell's investments in the fossil fuel industry by 2020 and reinvest 30% of the funds in companies involved in renewable energy initiatives. For the last 30 years, identity politics has attracted the sustained attention of more students than any other cause. Indeed, it has taken hold, in our judgment, with greater force and ferocity in colleges and universities, including Cornell, than in other institutions in the United States. Calling attention to the limitations of research and teaching focused exclusively on the achievements of great white men, many professors in the humanities and social sciences have contributed to the domination in universities of identity politics. The emphasis on society, history, and culture from the perspective of previously silenced men and women has also, however, been used to expose what some view as flaws at the core of American society. For students, many of whom are teenagers, in the process of forming a stable sense of self, the appeal of identity politics, with its self-confirming dynamic and its demand for recognition and respect, is self-evident. Having been told they were nobodies. Todd Gitlin, the Columbia University sociologist, has noted, they were now in a position to insist they were somebodies. Administrators, and I am an administrator, administrators who recoil at the prospect of unrest, protest, violence, and bad publicity, and endorse affirmative action as a worthy principle and policy, have found identity politics hard to resist, except when it seemed to be turning groups into fortified enclaves, hardening into separatism, and attracting unfavorable and unwanted public scrutiny. And that's the balancing act. That's the balancing act. Identity politics has been a fact of life at Cornell since the 1980s. Ethnic studies programs proliferated. Administrators struggled to comply with Title IX provisions against discrimination on the basis of sex. The existence of Ujamaa, the recruitment of first-year students to live in it, and a recommendation to make random housing assignments for freshmen were hotly debated, and still, to some extent, are being hotly debated, often prompting hundreds of student protesters to take to the streets. In the 1980s and 1990s, Hispanic students took over Day Hall. Their leader, Eduardo Penalver, who went on to be a Rhodes Scholar and a distinguished law professor, has now begun a term as dean of the Cornell Law School. So what goes around sometimes comes around. And in fact, he wrote a note to former Provost Bal Nesheim in which he said, "I believe my tenure as dean of the Cornell Law School will be my penance for the grief I gave administrators when I was an undergraduate." Agwego, a Mohawk word meaning all of us, the American Indian House on North Campus, opened its doors. Jewish students got a kosher dining hall. A program in Asian American studies was launched. And of course, identity politics certainly played a role in Hunter Rawlings' decision to house all freshmen on North Campus. And gay students, pointing to the recent establishment of a Latino Living Center and claiming they were not getting the respect and recognition accorded to other groups, demanded that space be set aside for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. In 2013, the university established a Muslim cultural center to showcase the diversity of Muslim culture and provide support for any person who identified as a Muslim. That fall, for the first time in Cornell's history, I wonder how many of you noticed this, students in on-campus housing were permitted to have a roommate of another gender. Of 3,340 undergraduates who signed up for the residential lottery, 26 opted for gender-inclusive housing on West Campus. All of them chose gender-inclusive suites, not gender-inclusive rooms, though I don't know how reassuring that was for parents. Students, faculty, and administrators, in our judgment, have not been very good at discussing the implications, positive and negative, of identity politics. Witness, for example, the recent firestorm over the decision to shift the Africana Studies and Research Center from the administrative oversight of the Provost Office to that of the College of Arts and Sciences. The public statements on all sides, we believed, cited good reasons, but not always the real reasons for the positions that were taken on each side. we do not do well in dealing with this vexing problem. And Cornell continues to struggle to find ways of establishing and supporting additional communities to complement what we consider to be the legitimate place of ethnicity, race, and gender in identity, to make the whole more than some of its parts. Institutions and societies can, and in our judgment, they should, maintain a healthy tension between a host of overlapping interest-based affinities and loyalties, identity rooted in an individual's background, and the common good. Assimilation and identity politics need not be opposites. They can exist in a dynamic tension, and in our judgment, they should. But it isn't easy. At Cornell, as elsewhere, identification with one's graduating class has declined. Just perhaps not as much as the disappearance of the freshman beanie and hazing of first-year students. Intercollegiate sports does not bring the community together as it once did in the 1940s and 50s, and still does at institutions like Duke and Michigan. The building blocks of bonding with fraternity and sorority brothers and sisters are also undergoing what we view as a long overdue reevaluation. And Slope Day is not our idea of Cornell at its best. Dragon Day comes closer. Dragon Day comes closer. Cornell's experimental common learning initiative, started by President Rhodes to combat specialization and provide general education courses to help students with varying backgrounds and viewpoints better understand common questions, values, social priorities, and global concerns, did not endure. For about a decade, the Book Project has aspired to help first-year students who now share the same living space come together around a common intellectual experience. Whether that is doing what it was intended to do, not yet clear. Far more ambitious, of course, is the West Campus House system, which brings faculty and students together in intellectual and social communities, and importantly at meals, in an initiative designed as a landmark opportunity to enhance fundamentally the undergraduate experience at Cornell and provide another positive source of identity. We ask that you stay tuned along with us to see how it all works out. Many students, it's worth emphasizing, are indifferent or even hostile to identity politics. Lots of them probably do not think all that much about a Cornell whole that is greater than the sum of its parts. Indeed, the diversity of backgrounds, values, and views among Cornell students should be a source of strength and pride, even as it makes it tough for observers like us to generalize about them. But generalizations we have made, and I want to conclude with a few more, based largely on my own observations. Students, faculty, and alumni at Cornell have a lot to be proud of. The Sierra Club recently designated Cornell as one of its top 10 coolest schools. At the same time, the number of applicants show that Cornell is one of the hottest schools around. At the end of March, Cornell accepted 14% of more than 43,000 applicants to the class of 2018. The number of applicants was a record high. As measured by grade point average, SAT and ACT scores, the current crop are more academically accomplished than their predecessors, including, dare we say it, some folks in this room. These students are better traveled and much more religious. These students are more politically conservative and more socially liberal than their predecessors. These students, in some ways, are more sophisticated than those who came before them. Gay marriage, for example, is not an issue on the Cornell campus. And these students tend to be pretty close to their parents. The revolutions in technology, with its cell phones, emails, and text messages, and Facebook posts help, of course, but so do the attributes of current parents, who are less inhibited, more sexually liberated, more open, and more permissive than parents who came of age during the Great Depression and World War II. On the other hand, today's students are more brittle than students we have taught in the past. Accustomed to praise and high grades, they do not take criticism all that well. Some of them do not take it at all. Nor do they read and write as much or as well as students who came before them. Concerned about and at times obsessed with their career prospects, current students spend lots of time applying for internships, revising resumes and cover letters, choosing practical courses, a minor in business, a double major, a triple major, a quintuple major, because they will look good to professional school admissions committees and or employers, not because they're intellectually engaged with the subject matter. On the other hand, how many hands have I got here? Cornell students are generous, compassionate, and committed to public service. As some of you may know, Cornell sends more students to the Peace Corps, to Teach for America, and similar organizations than all but a handful of universities in the United States. As the response to Katrina demonstrated, Cornell students give the lie to the claim that this generation is selfish and self-serving. In 1965, at the celebration of Cornell's centennial, and we're about to celebrate Cornell's sesquicentennial, in 1965, Morris Bishop, who had graduated from Cornell in 1918, who was a professor of Romance Studies, university historian, writer of light verse in The New Yorker, Morris Bishop, who had known Andrew Dixon White when Bishop was an undergraduate, reflected on the university's march toward the realization of Ezra Cornell's dream to become a university of the first magnitude, a foremost seat of learning in America. Noting that no one in the audience would be present at the bicentennial celebration of 1965, Bishop expressed confidence that the work of Cornell undergraduates, graduate and professional students, alumni and faculty, quote, will then be called to account. You too will be part of history. And he ventured to hope that a speaker on that Charter Day celebration, quote, will confirm my words today, that there can be no great creation without a dream, that giant towers rest on a foundation of visionary purpose, that our realities are at bottom spiritual. We are now halfway between 1965 and 2065. And as I yield the podium to Isaac, my colleague, collaborator, and best friend, I can think of no more fitting end to this discussion of students than to affirm with Professor Bishop that it is our solemn duty to bring the dreams of Ezra Cornell and Andrew Dixon White, quote, to earth, to house them in stone, to plant them in the spirits of the teachers and the taught, and to look forward and not back, and without forgetting old wisdom, to seek wisdom ever new, to prepare an even greater Cornell. Thank you.
I want to take a second to explain the title of this talk, which is The Way We Were and The Way We Are, which has the obvious suggestion that we are talking about the way Cornell was in the last 50 to 75 years and the way we are today. But perhaps some of you in the audience recognize the phrase, The Way We Were, because it, of course, was the name of a film in 1972, with Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford, which was, of course, written by Arthur Laurent, a Cornellian, the class of, I believe, 37 or 38. Thank you. You see what a team we have here. and in the film, you may remember that Barbara Streisand, of course, sings the title song of that. But the film begins Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford are lovers on a college campus. And that is, of course, meant to be. It isn't mentioned in the film, but in Arthur Laurent's mind when he wrote the film, it is, of course, his beloved Cornell, where he remembers a young woman student who was a radical communist, who happens to be, by the way, the mother of someone who lives in Ithaca still today. We thought, and it is not filmed at Cornell, by the way, but the collegiate images are memories in Laurent's mind of Cornell. This is all in his autobiography, which he wrote a few years ago, just before he died. Several years ago, and that's where the title comes from. It's a kind of inside Cornell joke. Not joke, but reference. Let me now turn to talk about the faculty, where there has been change as well as continuity these past 50 years. I should say by way of warning that my friends think that I can sometimes be a little cranky, often telling stories with internal contradictions, never describing a favorable change without mentioning its less appealing shadowed side. On the one hand this, on the other hand that. And I confess to this flaw in my character. I like to make history more complicated, since it seems to me it often is. For example, the faculty are certainly more diverse today than they were 50 years ago. That's on the one hand. But on the other, the faculty, of course, is not diverse enough. In the 1960s and 1970s, professors at Cornell were virtually all men, with the exception of a fairly large number of women faculty in the College of Home Economics, renamed the College of Human Ecology in 1968. Today, there are certainly more women faculty, but still, only 28% of the faculty are women. 72% of the faculty are men. At the same time,
Faculty, we are glad to say, are no longer all white. Just slightly over 80% are white, with 7% African-American or Hispanic-American faculty, and 9% of the faculty are Asian-American. As elsewhere in American professional life, there are more openly gay faculty here now than were here when many of you might have been students. In terms of their politics, faculty are still, as they have been for decades, fairly liberal. Though it must be said, it varies, as it always has, by college at Cornell. The Arts College, ILR, and Humane College faculty are much more liberal than, say, the Ag and Engineering faculty, and certainly more than the Hotel and Business School faculty. There are a few outspoken conservatives on campus, probably more than in the past, but still very few. One final point about who the faculty are today at Cornell, and it's an important point. Virtually none of the faculty are adjuncts. A good deal of public attention is now being given to the increasing number of colleges in the United States which hire less expensive part-time faculty to teach courses, creating a kind of underclass professoriate. Cornell, like the rest of the Ivy League, has a very tiny number of adjunct faculty. So to summarize, there has been a change in who the faculty are, but no great change. The Cornell faculty is still mainly men, mainly white, mainly straight, and mainly left of center. Where there has been truly dramatic change, however, is in what these faculty do, in what faculty life is like at Cornell and at all elite research universities which have a distinguished faculty. Now, the traditional role of faculty in places like Cornell, one that has been mythologized in books and movies, movies like Goodbye, Mr. Chips, the traditional role was firstly mentoring students. They provided counsel and advice as these young people confronted the new personal career and life choices that came with adult emancipation. Personal time with professors and office hours provided the life coaching in earlier generations. I have to tell you of a little story that just occurred this week. Glenn and I are both teaching a course for Cornell Adult University this week on the history of Cornell. And an alum couple who graduated in the 50s, are you here, the Henningers? An alum couple who both met here in the 50s, he a chemistry major and she a classics major, told me the other day and after class that when they were dating here in the 50s, her advisor, the great Harry Kaplan, the great classics professor, when he was told by her that she had a boyfriend, insisted that she bring her boyfriend to meet him in office hours to get his approval. So she did, and he later told her that he seems like a nice man. A year later, they were engaged to be married after graduation, and Kaplan insisted that she bring him back for yet another interview, which she did, and they knew that he had passed the test when Kaplan opened a drawer in his desk and pulled out a bottle of whiskey and toasted the two of them. Now that's what college advising and mentoring used to be like. Now I suspect, as is often the case, and perhaps here a little bit too, this view of professors as mentoring with life coaching is the product of nostalgia as well as the way things were. The second traditional role of professors was to be teachers, people who open the minds of students to the world of ideas, humanistic and scientific ideas. It was hoped, and to some extent expected, that the Ivy League professor would take the product of America's decidedly uneven public school system and free them from the parochial and conventional wisdom of family, neighborhood, and hometown, opening them up to a new world outside themselves and their connections, a new world of ideas. Now, no one has captured these two traditional roles of faculty better than Cornell's unofficial poet laureate, E.B. White, class of 1921, the author, of course, of Stuart Little, Charlotte's Web, a mainstay of the New Yorker magazine. At Cornell, White, a brother of Phi Gamma Delta and editor-in-chief of the Cornell Sun, had a particularly close relationship with his English professor, Bristow Adams, who lived across the Fall Creek Gorge in Cornell Heights. This is what White wrote about his beloved mentor many years later in a 1957 letter to Professor Adams' recent widow, in which he reminisced, White reminisced, about his college years over three decades earlier. Quote, "Those first years at Cornell were lonely ones for me. The pages of my diary are full of homesickness and other sorrows. But at your house, I found relief. And in that upstairs room, sitting with B.A., dispensing a good deal more than entertainment and coffee, I guess it was his knack of treating a young man as a companion rather than an oddity that made all the difference. I remember so well how good it was for the ego, the spirit, and even the intellect. I used to walk back across the suspension bridge at midnight, feeling all smoothed out and peaceful. Oh, those nights at the Adamses." End of quote. And here is how E.B. White captured the second role of the faculty, of traditional role of the faculty, opening their minds to the world of ideas. Late in his life, E.B. White wrote of a class with a Cornell historian, and this is what he wrote. "I wasn't particularly interested in the Middle Ages, but I was trying to get an education and was willing to listen to almost anything. The professor was a little old gentleman named George Lincoln Burr. For the first few days, his class in history seemed pretty much like any other college class. But as Professor Burr talked, something began to happen. Somehow I seemed to be transported into another century, and I began living in the dark days when a few men who still called their souls free were struggling against tyrants and bigots, struggling to preserve what priceless shreds of knowledge and truth the world had at that time managed to scrape together. My chance encounter with George Lincoln Burr was the greatest single thing that ever happened in my life, for he introduced me to a part of myself that I hadn't discovered. I saw with blinding clarity how vital it is for man to live in a free society. The experience enabled me to grow up almost overnight. It gave my thoughts and ambitions a focus. It caused me indirectly to pursue the kind of work which eventually enabled me to earn my living. But far more important than that, it gave me a principle of thought and action for which I have tried to fight and for which I shall gladly continue to fight the remainder of my life." Now again, let me remind you that this is, of course, partly a product of nostalgia as well as the way things were. There were indeed many Bristow Adamses and George Burrs on the Cornell faculty, but many professors in the good old days, including, alas, the great Carl Becker, were neither very good teachers nor all that accessible to students. But the very ideal of what faculty do has been seriously challenged in the last 50 years, and some say has come close to being totally abandoned. Happily, as I will argue in a few minutes, this traditional ideal has proved resilient. It is still here, if less mythic, as a description of faculty life. The changes I'm about to describe may appear to have produced a paradox, an alteration in faculty interests and practices that seem bound to threaten the intellectually nurturing role they have traditionally assumed in student life. This threat has not come to pass. While the faculty experience at Cornell has changed, the overriding responsibility to students survives and is unchanging. But now let me describe first the dramatic changes in the faculty experience this past half century, and then turn to the restorative response. The daily routine, activities, and priorities of the faculty used to be campus-focused. Teaching, advising, research, university committees, faculty meetings. The professor's academic life was grounded here in Ithaca, in the classrooms, libraries, and labs of Ithaca. A professor's reputation, fame, and distinction were assessed and judged by students, department colleagues here in Ithaca, and by the Cornell Sun. Over the years, faculty interests, commitments, and priorities have dramatically shifted off campus to off campus involvements. As professors, our fame, our rewards, our professional visibility and sense of importance comes today primarily from outside of campus. We are important if we are invited to speak at Duke or Stanford, invited to a conference in Tokyo or Bellagio, or to consult in Washington or on Wall Street. Many of us are thus more committed now to an abstract off-campus professional community called chemistry professors or English professors, whose existence, of course, is worldwide, and are standing in that group and in the national and international organizations in each discipline than we are to collegial campus-based life as a professor and teacher at Cornell. When I arrived here in 1972, faculty seldom left campus except during breaks or vacations. Now we will fly off to give a talk, attend a conference, do a consultantship in the middle of term, juggling and rearranging our classes. Some years ago, I used to pose this riddle, and some of you are of an age to understand my reference. The riddle asks the question, why is the Cornell faculty like the airplanes in the Strategic Air Command? Answer, because at any particular time, 25% of them are in the air. Or as I sometimes still say to my students, with paradoxical irony, you know you're at a great university because your faculty are not always here. That's a sign of how good they are. If they were always here, it means no one else wants to hear them. Now, lots of factors have contributed to this shifting of faculty expectations, priorities, and focus off campus, and to what I call the rise of the peripatetic professor. Have talk, have consultancy, we'll travel. Most important was the growth of the research university during the Cold War, when government money, mainly from the Defense Department and the National Science Foundation, started pouring into universities for basic research in the natural and social sciences. Faculty priorities and rewards shifted from being a local campus star to fame acquired through publicly acclaimed research. There was new money coming into campuses from grants given by foundations like Ford and Rockefeller, and from private corporations like DuPont and IBM. There was money for higher faculty salaries and for travel. No longer were Cornell faculty paid monastics sequestered in Ithaca. There was money for travel that took you to conferences, to lecture colleagues and graduate students at Berkeley or Michigan, or to consult in New York or London, all of which, of course, is extremely pleasant. Let me describe for you what happens when you give an important late afternoon lecture on campus to the Cornell community. A few students and a few people from downtown who recognize your name come to the talk. Virtually no colleagues come, and the room is half empty. We won't say anything about this evening. You finish the talk to the half-empty room. None of your colleagues are there. There's a few students, a couple of people from downtown. You finish the talk, and you walk home or drive home to the usual dinner with your family. Now, let's suppose you're invited to give a talk at Duke. You are met at the airport and whisked off to drinks with adoring graduate students who know your research and have read your books. You give a talk packed with students and faculty eager to see the visiting superstar from Cornell. You then go to a sumptuous dinner, again surrounded by the ever-present adoring graduate students, and finally off to sleep in a quiet room in a lovely campus inn. I ask you, what's not to like about off-campus professional life? And it also comes, of course, with the modest honorarium, as we call it in academic life, of maybe $1,000 for all of this trouble that you've gone through. Now, here is the important point. If faculty today are spending so much time off campus, something has to give. We have only a finite amount of time. What traditional academic responsibilities do we drop? Cornell presidents Dean Malott and James Perkins worried about that even as they presided over Cornell developing into a major research university in the 1960s. They presciently predicted, as Perkins did in 1966, that, quote, increasingly mobile professors will be attracted to professional and practical life beyond the campus and will neglect mentoring, advising, and teaching eager students. And they were right. The quality of our classroom instruction remains excellent, but student advising and life mentoring have become a lower priority for faculty. This vacuum has been filled by the growth of a new professional academic advising staff in each college who do a lot of what professors used to do, advise and mentor students, walk them through their homesickness, help them craft a sound academic schedule, and engage them in career discussions. There are other things the new peripatetic faculty do less of. What tends also to be dropped is campus collegial life, by which I mean the extent that faculty guide and shape and even control what happens on campus. This too has been left to a professional class, a new academic managerial class of vice presidents and vice provosts and deans and assistant deans. The demise of the faculty meeting is an example of this casualty. Arts College faculty meetings, when I came here in 1972, were well attended, often by 300 to 400 of the college's then 600 faculty. In the tumultuous 1960s and during the South African divestment crisis of the 1980s, meetings of the cross-college university faculty often had 1,000 faculty in attendance. And these meetings were great theater, with the likes of Mike Abrams and Max Black and Fred Kahn crossing swords with the likes of Alan Bloom and L. Pierce Williams. Today, if you get 50 arts college professors to come to a meeting, you are lucky, and the issue is probably about faculty parking. The Arts College, in fact, now has most of its important collective decisions not made in face-to-face faculty meetings, for which you never could get a quorum, but electronically in virtual meetings through computer voting, which is a truly amazing and worrisome development in the depersonalization of campus life. Now, don't misunderstand me. There were and there still are important institutional benefits from this new peripatetic faculty model, even as undergraduate advising has taken the biggest hit. The new model enabled Cornell to acquire and retain one of the most distinguished faculties in the world. And these faculty, whose horizons are international, not local, win Nobel Prizes, Pulitzer Prizes. They win grants. They appear as talking heads on TV. They get quoted by other important people in the chattering classes, all of which brings Cornell glory, honor, and, to be sure, favorable public notice and attention. At every academic conference around the globe, at every UN meeting on food production, the participating Cornell professor, who may be missing class that day, is planting the Cornell flag, announcing that Cornell is a player, a major player, a world-class leader in thought, and a world-class leader in the practical application of knowledge. The payoff to the university provided by its traveling peripatetic professors is priceless and is indeed encouraged, of course, by the university. But, as I assured you when I began, there are also in recent years vital signs of a revised focus of Cornell faculty on their traditional roles of mentoring and enlightening undergraduates. Like this generation of young people, Cornell faculty are good at multitasking. They can be away from campus on occasion and be very student-focused when they are here, which even cranky me has to acknowledge is, of course, most of the time. Let me also lay to rest one canard about research-focused professors, which is good news. The fear that faculty doing publicly acclaimed research could not be great teachers has proved groundless. The evidence suggests that great Cornell scholars are usually great Cornell teachers who continue to open the minds of students who flock to their classes. Indeed, an argument could be made that teaching is far better today than in the good old days. There is less reliance on the lecture, which even at its best has been shown to be one of the least effective ways to impart knowledge. Altshuler and I ought to know we are lecture traditionalists who never use PowerPoint, as you can see. or Nazi. The introduction of audiovisual materials to presentations and homework assignments can enhance learning when carefully integrated with other material. So can the more interactive pedagogies, including clicker technology, which measure comprehension and give instructors feedback in real time. President Rawlings was particularly interested in the Cornell undergraduate experience and was concerned with the impact on it of what I have been describing as new faculty priorities. His response was the new house system on West Campus. In his presidency, the U-Halls were replaced by 5 houses, each with their own dining rooms, and each presided over by live-in senior faculty. The very names of the houses, legendary Cornell faculty names from the past, Alice Cook, Carl Becker, Hans Bethe, William Keaton, Flora Rose, signify that it is in these new living arrangements, not in faculty offices, that close faculty-student relationships are more likely to take place today. And what is truly amazing is that the faculty, peripatetic as they are flocking to be house professors, following the wonderful pioneer efforts of Ross Brand and Cindy Hazan, and that each week scores of faculty share meals and conversation with students in the new house dining rooms. Another hopeful sign of a revival of closer faculty-student interactions is the tremendous growth in the number of students doing independent research under individual faculty sponsorship. Each semester, hundreds of undergraduates, mainly in the sciences to be sure, but increasingly in the social sciences and humanities as well, work closely in a shared research relationship with many of the distinguished faculty who on occasion may be out of town. Contact with students outside the classroom is on the rise all over campus. We see the proliferation of teams in the College of Engineering, for example, where faculty work with students to build race cars and energy-efficient homes and enter them into national contests. Look at the phenomenally successful first-year reading project, which since first introduced in 2000 by the then Provost Biddy Martin, now president of Amherst College, has 3,200 first-year students read a book, usually a novel, over the summer to be discussed in small seminar settings their first weekend at Cornell. Now, what makes this work are the nearly 200 faculty who volunteer to read the book over the summer as well, and then lead the discussion sections in late August. These faculty, by the way, come from departments all over the university, from arts, engineering, ILR, hotel, human ecology, agriculture, even business, law, and the vet school. So despite the forces in recent years pulling faculty away from campus life, we still have our fair share, or more than our fair share, of professors who, like Bristow Adams, treat young men and women like companions and colleagues and leave them, though perhaps not at midnight, feeling smoothed out and peaceful. And we have our fair share, more again than our fair share, of professors like George Burr, who open the minds of today's students, who, as E.B. White said of him, quote, introduce them to a part of themselves waiting to be discovered. The good news, then, is that just as in 1917, when the freshman E.B. White arrived in Ithaca by train, so the new Cornellians today, 100 years later, will still find great teachers. The bad news is that, unlike E.B. White, today's new Cornell students cannot arrive by train. Let me say proudly that we, the Cornell faculty, young assistant professors, and older traveling academic superstars, still change students' lives And we know this because, like E.B. White, they tell us so. They write to us and they tell us, and at reunions they come and tell us how important they were in their lives, even recent graduates. I want to share one of these stories with you about one particular alum who will remain nameless, who wrote to me some years after he left Ithaca, particularly thankful to his old professor, me, for some help I had provided him It's an unusual story of the impact I had on his life, which still delights me and thrills me when I think, at the end of the day, why am I doing this? What effect do I have on students? Before I read this wonderful thank you, professor, email, I need to provide some background to explain some references in the email he sent me. A few years ago, I co-wrote with Larry Moore of our history department a book on church-state relations in America with the title The Godless Constitution. As part of the publicity for the book, I was interviewed one weekend. Larry was out of the country then. I was interviewed one weekend on Ira Glass's NPR show, This American Life. Some months later, I received the following email from a former student living in Seattle thanking me for how I had transformed his life. This is what he wrote. Professor Kramnik, do I have a story for you? Whimsically, as I was on my way out the door to catch the bus this morning, I grabbed a copy of The Godless Constitution and put it in my gym bag. After work, I had a date with this girl I met last weekend at the outdoor festival. Anyway, she picked me up at work, and This American Life was on the radio. We're chatting and listening to it in the background, and then all of a sudden, you're in the car with us. I'm like, wow, that's my college advisor. So it's a great discussion you're giving, and we pull the car into an empty parking lot so we can listen more. Then you start talking about the book, which I produce from my gym bag. It's not often I have such a great in with girls now. I moved to Seattle, and I've been here a year. But outside of work, my social network is still very limited. But I've somehow managed, because I have no shame, to go on a lot of dates that all end up being horrible because I have nothing to talk with a girl about and nothing to bond over, other than the place I met her, usually a bar or the gym. So as a result of the radio program, that this girl and I are talking about politics, something you don't do on a first date. And subsequently, the whole evening just went smoothly. We clicked. The first time I've had what I'd call a satisfying conversation on a date since I got here. I'm going out with her again next week. Do you think you could arrange to be on the radio more often? It could do wonders for my social life. So with this rather unusual, to be sure, but happy example of how many other different ways that Cornell professors affect the lives of our students, let me now bring to an end to Professor Altshuler's and my personal reflections on changes and continuities in Cornell students and faculty over the many years we two have been here. We have discovered in the research for our book that one very important thing about Cornell has not changed. Cornell began as, and still is, the most egalitarian of elite schools. We are still the Ivy League school with a Big Ten soul. And the members of Cornell's class of 2018 who arrived this fall, one of whom, by the way, is my granddaughter, in this, our sesquicentennial year, will forge their identity here during their four years on campus. They will create that self with the help of a world-class faculty and with all that this historic university community offers. And all this will happen for them, as it did for some of you, during their magical 4-year retreat from the real world that they spend up here on East Hill, far above Cayuga's waters and far above the busy humming of the bustling town. Thank you.
So,
it's 25 after 8. We can stay for questions till about 10:30 or 11.
So you have a choice. Either you can ask questions or I can sing the way we were. Can it be?
Or we can rush out. Or you can rush out and buy 10 books.
That's right.
Any questions or comments?
There,
you don't there need
are
to make
some. There's a microphone, so please come up.
It doesn't have to be a question. It can be your own reflections on students and faculty or response.
Thank you. I can speak loud. I believe I'm a frequent denizen of Call Auditorium and one of the perpetrators of the dreaded business minor, Pedro Perez. But I have a question about our students. One thing that was mentioned is the ubiquitous Wi-Fi and the mobile devices. And I find that they have an enormous influence on the behavior of students, and they may be what we are talking about 50 years from now. Professor Altshuler, do you have something to tell us about this newfangled set of technologies?
Say again, what?
The electronics, cell phones.
Electronics.
Oh. The new technology.
Yeah, I mean, I have to be honest with you. I worry a lot about the new technology for this reason principally. I think the new technology, iPhones especially, not only reduce attention spans, but they make young people incessantly interruptible. And so they've annihilated the present. Young people now cannot abide their own company. That's not a good thing. And it seems to me that there are wonderful tendencies of the new technology. It permits connections with others that are unprecedented. It allows people to get together with those who are like-minded and those who differ with others. But it also contains the likelihood of increasing some tendencies that were already there with television, and we see it in our own classes where students hit the iPhone 8 seconds after class is over or play video games while they're listening to Isaac's lecture, not mine, but those things are worrisome, and we're in early days. It'll be interesting to see how it sorts out.
There are some times when it's helpful to a professor. For example, I was lecturing one day last year about Woodrow Wilson, and I don't know what, something caught my fancy, and I said, I think he was, there have been two U.S. presidents who, three U.S. presidents who have been college professors, and college presidents, I actually said. And I said, Wilson, and I said, Eisenhower, which, of course, surprises today's students. I guess that was it. Obama was a college professor. But then 3 minutes go by, and a student raises his hand. He'd obviously Googled it. And, in fact, there's a third U.S. president. Anyone know who was a president of a college?
Yeah,
no.
James A. Garfield.
Give that man a cigar. My concern about cell phones... is that I have students, of course, I walk to campus across the bridge from, I live just across the Thurston Avenue Bridge, and I walk to campus, and I see students often in the morning talking to their dads and moms before they leave. I have students who tell me they talk to their parents 6-7 times a day. And I remember the days when you used to line up on Sunday morning to make your weekly call. And I wonder which enhances emancipation and discovery of self, talking to parents 8 times a day or talking to a parent once a week. Next question.
Thank you.
Thanks, Professor Altshuler and Kramnikol. I'm a student just enrolled this fall season. So you're
a freshman.
Yes. And I'll take your advice and keep the radio on whenever I date it. My question is that do you guys have any suggestion for the international student how that we can get involved in the Cornell culture quickly as quickly as we can?
Well, we've now had, and you're evidence of it, a dramatic increase in international students. And so here's some advice for you. What's your background? What country are you from?
Sorry, I came from China. I'm an LLR master program.
Okay.
2 years.
So I would say that it would be great if you spent a lot of time with other Chinese students, but don't spend all that much time with other Chinese students. And immerse yourself in a whole range of activities that will get you involved. It's a myth that first-year students do better academically if they don't join organizations. They do better if they do join organizations, and that's the way to meet people. One other piece of advice, when you sit down in a big lecture class, when most students sit in the same seat all the time, introduce yourself to the person to the left and to the right and suggest coffee. It's a good way to get to know people.
I think you should go to the farmer's market every Saturday morning until Christmas.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dave Dresser, class of 60. My question is for Professor Altshuler.
Alzheimer's is my name.
No. I should explain that I am a school board member, and we have a teacher named Alzheimer. So, Altshuler, you mentioned the increase in religious aspects in the religious activity of students. We have an institution as hallmark of non-sectarian education. And we have a growing research nationally that suggests that nuns, N-O-N-E-S, are more prevalent. And could you comment on the increasing religiosity of Cornell students?
The United States remains the most religious of all developed countries by a very, very large margin. And I would also say, this is my one-sentence history lesson, one reason for the religiosity of Americans is the non-denominationalism in the United States, which has encouraged all kinds of religious beliefs. We've also had worldwide and in the United States in the last 30 or 40 years, an increase in religiosity vis-a-vis fundamentalist belief, and that's reflected in our student body. So there's been a movement at Cornell, as in the country, away from establishment religious belief and toward somewhat more sectarian religious belief, and you can see that in the number of religious organizations.
And it's also a question of who of the nature of the students who come to Cornell. So you have now over 20% of the students who are Asian American. Large numbers of them are Korean Americans. And of course, South Korea is virtually all Christian. We have now a large number of Russian Jews, most of whom are both politically conservative and religiously conservative. We also are one of the few schools that still has an all-women's dormitory, Balch Hall. The university was not able to break the will, which made it up to be a woman's. And it attracts Muslim women, Orthodox Jewish women, and you now walk through the campus and you, what you see, what you didn't see 30 years ago, is you see young men wearing skull caps, you see young women wearing scarves. This is a very different place than it was, and it's all to the better, of course.
Okay, other questions, comments?
Thank you all for coming, or you can stay if you like. We're going to leave.
Oh, wait a minute. Wait. A last-minute question.
Oh, my God. Yes, sir. You're not a freshman, are you?
I'd just like you to comment about veterans and other non-traditional students after World War II, Korean War, and non-traditional students such as transfer students and older students attending Cornell and what impact they've had on the university.
Cornell, like many other institutions, and after 1945, had as a majority of its students returning GIs, and they changed the character of the institution. Cornell has also always retained its ROTC, which is not true in many other institutions, and so it's always had a presence of students affiliated with the military. Because Cornell is, as they say, centrally isolated, we don't have part-time students, degree candidates, and we don't have all that many older students. Those tend to be associated with more urban campuses. So the student body tends to be almost exclusively 17 to 22-year-olds still. I'm talking about undergraduates, of course.
Glenn and Isaac, I just wanted to thank you personally on behalf of the athletes that you've helped. And Glenn, you mentioned earlier that I'm the director of athletics at Cornell, but I want to thank you for the mentoring and the work that you do with students who are really trying to find themselves. Glenn, we go back a long way, and we know the names of the many students you've sat down with and worked with through their career. And I think you're both terrific professors and terrific people, and I just want to thank you on behalf of the individuals that I work with.
Thanks, Dad.
Hi. I had a question relating to one of the comments you made in your presentation, Professor Altshuler, about political engagement of students and the changes since the 60s and 70s. You said there's been a lot less political engagement in more recent years, and you made some caveats. But I'm wondering if, I'm sure you've, both of you have probably thought about how that could change in the future. And I was wondering if we were to be optimistic about student political engagement and protest, or at least activism in one way or another, and say 5, 10, 15 years from now, there's a resurgence of public spiritedness and so on among, let's say, Cornell students. We're going to imagine this scenario. What kind of factors do you think could cause that?
The draft?
Yeah, a draft would be extremely helpful. It's a great question and a very important question. And, you know, we're both historians, and as you know, there's no future in history. So it's a little difficult for us to have any more wisdom than you have. I would just make an observation. I think, and I tried to say this,
that students are now socially engaged, but they're not political. They're socially engaged in community enterprises, in Teach for America, in other organizations. And I wish I didn't have to say this, but our politics now does not deserve political engagement. It's not a good use of people's time. It's a horrible thing to say, but I think there's much truth in it, and we have the very difficult chicken and egg issue of how you change politics to get people engaged, or whether you get people engaged to change politics. It's going to take, in my judgment, and again, I regret to say this, it's going probably to take either a crisis of even greater magnitude than we had in 2008-2009, or leadership that can somehow connect with people and get us beyond the paralysis and the mendacity that we have in American politics. Who would want to serve in political office in this environment? And breaking through that is going to take something that I just don't have the wisdom to see the way through to it. So I wish I had a better answer to your question. Isaac has a better answer to your question. Thank God.
I just have an observation. In terms of thinking, well, it would take a disaster, or it would take an extended period of warfare or something. The United States has been at war since 2003, has been at war for 10 years. And what many of you who do not spend your time on this campus don't know is that for this past 10 years, there has been a deafening silence on the part of student protests. There has been virtually no protest against any wars on this campus for the last 10 years. And to the extent that there were, the people who showed up were, of course, old 60s, 70s faculty who are teaching here. Old 60s, 70s types who are teaching here, as opposed to the students. It is amazing. And it's not, by the way, unconnected to the first question about the importance of social media and technology. Yes, social media and technology can mobilize people very quickly in Cairo or in Baghdad or Middle East Spring, but social technology also isolates people, and it also provides a platform for your announcing your political views and your political identity without having to go in front of the straight the way that it used to be, the way that you identified what your politics were in some kind of public political theater. It's the total demise of public political theater, which is so striking on campus. People are civic-minded, students are civic-minded, public-spirited. There is a very active group at the ILR who work on sweatshops and are constantly holding the president's feet to the fire of getting rid of sweatshirts and things that are made in factories that don't abide by proper labor standards. Students are very interested in ecology and ecological movement. They are very interested in, as Professor Altschul has said, in identity issues, those things that mean a good deal to them in terms of their gender or their race. But somehow or other, the public response to national and international politics is absolutely absent on campus.
I had originally thought that the environment might be the route back into politics because it has such an impact on all of us, and I still think that may well be one route to it. But the environmental impact is for many people still such an abstraction that it's very difficult to see whether that ultimately will work. So we leave it to you ultimately to figure this out. You're young and obviously interested in these issues, and keep asking and keep talking to people about it.
Yes, way in the back. Well, it's clearly related to the absence of a draft. There's no doubt about the fact that the protest against the war in Vietnam was greatly impacted by the fear of being drafted and being sent to Vietnam. There's no doubt about it. It's unclear that there will never... I mean, one of the things that your question raises is the other side is the total absence of political leadership or political mobilization. Very few political figures mobilized students, even in the last election. In Obama's first election, there was an effort at student mobilization. But in the last election, neither Romney or Obama took great pains to mobilize students to get them involved in politics. And similarly, issues like a national service, not necessarily a draft, but national service, which Clinton floated for a while, no president has gone near it. Obama certainly hasn't even raised the subject. Of course, if there were a draft and we had a Democratic army, then there would be perhaps more protests on campus.
Okay, we want to thank you all for coming.